The Data Chief is a podcast for data and analytics leaders to share their personal stories and insights on technology, culture, and leadership. Welcome to The Data Chief.
Welcome to The Data Chief. I'm your host, Cindy Housen. Today, we're joined by Cameron Davies, the Chief Data Officer at Yum Brands, a company with iconic food and beverage retailers such as Taco Bell, KFC, Pizza Hut, and Habit Burger & Grill. In this episode, we'll discuss Cameron's fascinating career journey that spans from an early academic career to leading data and analytics at global giants like Disney, NBC Universal, and now Yum Brands. We'll also dive into his experience at scaling analytics across a distributed global footprint. Cameron, welcome to The Data Chief.
Thanks, Cindy. It's a pleasure to be here. I appreciate you having me.
The Data Chief is brought to you by ThoughtSpot, the agentic analytics platform company that is redefining how the world interacts with data. With ThoughtSpot's intuitive natural language search and agentic AI, every user can access transparent, governed, AI-powered insights when and where they need them. Learn why industry leaders like Cisco, Toyota, Hyatt, and Capital One rely on ThoughtSpot. Experience the new era of analytics at ThoughtSpot.com.
It's great to have you. And I know you speak around the world. You work with your teams around the world. Where are you joining us from today, Cameron?
So today I actually live in Charlotte, North Carolina, or just north of Charlotte in Davidson, North Carolina. And then, as you can imagine, a lot of travel back and forth to Texas, where we've got our kind of main offices.
So, Cameron, I know we share a love of data and analytics, but looking at your background, it looks like you're also a sports fan, football and basketball. Who's your teams?
You know, it's funny. There's actually a story behind each of those balls. I'm not that huge of a sports fan, but it all started with my favorite one up there, which is a Magic Johnson basketball growing up in the 70s and the Lakers and watching him. And I actually got a chance to meet him one time in person and have him sign the ball. And it just started a flow of things. People assumed that was my thing and it became more of them came my way. But my football team is the Dallas Cowboys. I grew up out west, Salt Lake. That was the closest one. And so they've always just sort of been my team. It almost feels cliche as America's team, but they're my folks.
It's not cliche. They're not America's team. We're like Packers. We're Packers fans in our house, even though I've never lived in Wisconsin. So I think it just depends.
There you go. I can't do it once Favre left. I just can't do it anymore.
Oh, yeah. Okay, now we're going to go down that rabbit hole. But betrayal to the nth degree there. So let's get back to data and analytics. You have worked across different industries. As you think about these different industries, what has been consistent across them?
Yeah. I always find it's interesting because I've been so blessed to work with some great companies. And even within some of those companies like Disney, you had this huge swath of things you could do. Started with parks and resorts. Within parks, you had a $1 billion merchandise business. You had a $2 billion hotel business. You had a $2 billion theme park business. You had a food and beverage business. So you got this huge diversity of things. And then when we expanded into media and studios and consumer products, you started to realize the business problem is the business problem. And
yes,
no matter what you do, and smart people know how to connect those dots. And that's sort of hasn't changed as I moved to Comcast, NBCU, and now into the QSR business. There's some uniqueness for sure. You never have as much data as you want, as fast as you want, as cleanly as you want. People are always people, but the opportunities are always the opportunities.
And I think as you describe it, Cameron, the business problem is the business problem. Do we as an industry focus too much on the how, which is the data and the tech, and not enough on the why, which really is the business problem?
I have a really good friend. His name's Manoj Saxena. And Manoj was the first GM of IBM Watson. when they purchased one of his companies. And we've been, he's been a good friend and mentor for a number of years. And I'll never forget the first time I met Manoj, because it was a capital or an equity conference in New York. And Manoj had a slide and it said, start with the business problem down, not the technology up. And it just so resonated with me. I've repeated it thousands of times since then. I always give Manoj credit, but I was so taken with it. I had to go meet him afterwards and have a conversation. It's like, hey, tell me how you think about this. Like, I am with you 100%. So I think the answer, that's a long answer to the question, which is yes. I think sometimes we get so enamored with the technology. Well, it's just all about being data-driven and the AI. We forget it's all in the service of a business problem.
Yeah. And I think staying focused on that why is really critical. When we're at a time of rapid innovation, it is sometimes you do have to start bottoms up. Like, what can the technology do? But then understanding where it can be applied in a business context is really the secret sauce.
Yeah. I mean, if you're not taking moonshots at some point, right, you're never going to be innovative. So I think what I've found across multiple industries, whether it's Disney, NBCU, even at Yum, we have a prioritization process where we say a certain percentage of the resources have to be applied in a certain way. Some of those are on those big bets that are secure. We know what they are. They hit big business sides. Another percentage is like we're in 160 countries across the globe. And as you can imagine, there's big and there's small. There's Taco Bell in the US, which is 7,000 plus stores. It's our biggest single brand market we own. But KFC, a lot of people don't realize, is huge around the globe, is our second twin growth pillar. And so that sort of becomes a long tail. And if you don't ever focus on the long tail never becomes part of the Pareto. And so how do you make sure that you allocate some of those resources to those growing and evolving markets? And then a piece where we call it our moonshots. What are those things that we just sort of need to work on because we see it coming and nobody's necessarily asking for it yet, but we know they will. A good example was with Gen AI. When we saw it coming early, we built our own internal agent factory. Like, we think this is going to be a thing. It's not a huge investment, so we can fail fast if we need to and small if we need to. But we think if we do it right, we'll be set to take advantage of it when it comes. And sure enough, it came the way we thought it was going to come. We made the right bet. And then it will launch us now into voice AI, which is one of our major bets within operations coming up.
So there's a few things there, Cameron, that I want to parse. First off, the scale of Yum Brands. And I know there's many more restaurants in the portfolio that people might be less familiar with. But when you think about that global scale and how they are sometimes autonomous business units, even franchises, how do you balance the centralization versus the decentralization for that agility and speed to market?
Yeah, what's such a great question, Cindy. If anybody has the perfect answer for this, please let me know. Because as you mentioned, we have a couple of situations we always try to balance. And they're just opportunities, which is that global scale across four different brands. Then you've got the fact that we're only 2% equity, which means 98% of our stores are owned and operated by our franchisee partners. And those deal structures are different around the globe. And some of those franchisee partners are huge and some of them are fairly small. And so what we're trying to do constantly, whether it's with what I do in data or what we're doing with our Bite by Yum suite of products that we're using to kind of put into our restaurants to make them easier to run, more efficient, more effective to run, is kind of create that level of it has to be demand driven across the board to start with. Like, it goes back to where we started on the business problem, because sometimes the problems are different, but there's a lot that are the same. So how do you start with the common threads that are the same? How do you find those areas where our scale is our biggest advantage and how we use it? And we've seen that recently by bringing our technology teams together across the globe and realizing that if you do that effectively, you can get a lot more efficient and effective at what you do as long as you balance out the voices of those markets. And this is what we talked about before, is sometimes this happens, and I've seen this happen in previous lives. You bring it all together and you say, all right, it's going to be a little bit slower now because it's centralized. It's going to be the big markets, the big brands are the only people that get attention, and it's going to be more expensive. Who's in?
Nobody.
And then we're surprised, right? Well, we're not. And so I think we at Yum have taken a really thoughtful approach. And I credit David Gibbs, who's our just outgoing CEO now. His last day was last week. Chris Turner, our incoming CEO, was our then CFO. Joe Park. Those folks that actually had a vision for this and how we think about it and do it in a really balanced way so that you try to kind of do your best. There's always going to be trade-offs, but how you minimize the bad things or those terrible things and minimize and maximize the good things.
Yeah. And you mentioned a couple things. So I do want to talk about by Yum, but if I take you back 2 years ago, you talked about fail fast and standing up an AI factory. Can you share a lesson learned, or like if you could do it over, what would you do differently for those that are just now really embarking on Gen AI?
Yeah, I think it's two things. And neither of them are non-obvious things, but it's sort of like if you take your health seriously, it's not enough just to get up and eat well once and exercise. It's sort of this daily journey you constantly have to remind yourself and have self-discipline to do. I think AI is like that, quite candidly. The one thing is, we go back, it's so easy to get enamored with the technology and how cool it is. Like, no, this was really cool. Like, and you show it to people, like, isn't this cool? And they're like, yeah, but what am I going to do with it? Like, no, it's really cool. You should use it. Like, yeah, but what am I going to do with it? And I liken that to the iPhone problem. Like, all right, I'm on a 15 Pro now. I'm going to go to a 16 Pro. Like, well, how will your life change? Well, I'll be $2,000 poorer. Right? But other than that, like, I mean, apparently my life won't change, right? But it's easy to get enamored that way. And so constantly reminding ourselves, especially as data scientists, as machine learning engineers, software engineers, like, look, just because it's cool doesn't mean it's useful.
Yes.
That's one. The second thing, I think we did it at Disney well, we do it at Yum well, is it's always people.
Mm.
And whether it's Gen AI, and I've been doing this a lot of years. There's a lot of gray hairs. There's pictures of 7 grandchildren behind me. I've been doing it a while. And I still have to remind myself of this, which is change management is the hardest part. Technology is actually a whole lot easier than people. And the more successful the people are, the harder it is to get them to change.
So, Cameron, we have been talking about change management for, well, decades, really. And I know you follow Tom Davenport and Randy Bean as well, their annual survey. Why is an organization not data-driven? 92% say people process lack of change management. I heard a stat last week. I believe the speaker was from Liberty Mutual, the CIO at Liberty Mutual. And she actually said, if you think about digital transformation and the internet, the last big wave, she would have said dollar for dollar, one investment in the tech, $1 investment in people change management. She thinks that for generative AI, it should be 3-1. What's your take?
3-1 might be high for my brain,
mm-hmm.
but the 2-1, maybe. You know, if I could share an example.
Please do.
We made some really strong investments early on when we saw this coming. We took our top 200 leaders and moved them through a digital versus basically academy by Stahl Neely at Harvard and brought her in. And we said, we're going to show you how to go do this. just to kind of, we got to start at the top and convince the top. And we made a significant investment in those top 200. Then we gave every above store leader access to Copilot within the Microsoft suite. So we'll pay for it. We'll centrally fund it. Here you go. And then we took another 200 plus leaders and we gave them direct access to a corporate wide license of GPT. But we didn't stop there. Then we started something called AI Academy. And we continue to start a set of training, best in class, share how you're doing it. We started training up trainers. We have a team on my team that's their job. And they literally are showing people now, here's how you can set up your own agents within GPT, your own efficiency agents to do these types of things for you. And what have you done? And we share it and we bring it in there. And then we've started doing that within our people and culture team, like train them how to go do it. So we've started making those investments and we're adding more people to that team next year because we really believe, or I really believe, that Gen AI is going to look a lot like this cell phone in my hand.
Yeah.
I remember, again, I'm old enough, sitting at Disney when half of us barely had a cell phone. Maybe we had the old Motorola flip phone. And I had this big, remember the big blueberry?
Yes.
Blackberry on my hip. And I had a laptop, but I had to justify my laptop, the cost of my laptop, because I traveled more than 40% at the time. And there were arguments like, well, should we pay? Like, should we pay for cell phones? Would we pay for iPhones? Should we move over? How's that going to pay for itself? Should we make this investment? And I remember having these big executive meetings about this and the cost of it. How would it ever pay off in efficiency? Now, I can't imagine a world. Like we don't even question it anymore. We don't even have desktops anymore. Everybody has laptops. Work anywhere. Like, it's not unusual. Maybe this is embarrassing for me to say, for me to be answering emails or Teams or whatever messaging app somebody has it at 10 o'clock at night doing something else. What would my efficiency look like if we went back to, if you need Cameron after hours, call his pager, hope he's near a landline. And if it's something that requires a computer, you're going to have to wait till he gets back in the office tomorrow.
Yeah, it's changed. Technology has changed the way we work and where we work. So to recap, you started this AI literacy and digital literacy at the top. You've expanded beyond it. So, and that's even before you're making the technology investments. So I think this people change management is a really good and important point that it's ongoing. Tell us more specifically about Byte by Yum. What is the problem you're trying to solve and what does that look like?
Yeah, I think the problem we're trying to solve is it has never been harder to run a restaurant in the history of restaurants. Competition has grown, aggregators, pricing pressure, cost pressure, people pressure, finding talent, retaining talent, the cost of that talent, digital explosions. Like I used to have like two channels, my drive-through and my front, like my POS. Now we do forecasting. It's like eight channels that I can get orders through. So it just becomes complex.
Yeah. So mobile ordering, and then other deliveries, whoever. Yeah.
Web. Mobile, kiosk, drive-through, aggregators, you name it. So what we're on a journey to do is how do we basically digitize the restaurant to make it easier to run? And that's what we're trying to do. So Byte's simply a collection of proprietary software that integrates behind a comprehensive, seamless operating system that makes it easier to acquire and run a restaurant. And that's it's the simplest level of what it does. And so it goes everything from our e-com, our front end, back end for our e-com ordering systems, all the way to our point of sale, our voice AI systems, our kiosk software, our back of house kitchen operating software and how you manage all of that. It's not 100% of what you need to run the restaurant, but it's the core software you need to run a restaurant from your architectural systems.
Right. So it's a better way to understand what consumers want, where they want it, when they want it, and then the restaurants can plan. Is there a fun data point or an unexpected data point that you can share with us? Maybe what we like to eat on a rainy day or special events, special sporting events, Cowboys versus Commanders?
Yeah, it's also unique to location. And I think that's the most interesting thing. I'll give you an example of this. We, for the first time this year, we have come closest, we think, to a true one-to-one marketing campaign. Along with our partner, we use an external partner, OfferFit. It was just recently purchased by Braze. We combine that with our internal data set called Red 360, where we have high quality first party data on over 140 million people in the US to drive that. And what you find is it's really interesting. If you look at one singular email, there's 150 dimensions to that email you could change and optimize. Some of the most powerful things actually are not the message itself. Some of the most powerful things are when you send the email, how often you send the email, and to whom, depending on the characteristics of the person you're sending it to. That could be location, it could be their last purchase. That uniqueness gets really, really interesting. And so you take some of our businesses that you send out one huge email blast a week, and they've done a lot of A/B testing and a lot of work to say, Tuesday morning, that's the morning. Send it out on Tuesday morning. Now, those emails go across all 7 days in different levels, all directly guaranteed at getting what exactly is the best way to get Cindy to respond.
Yeah, and for sure, I would say never a Monday morning because it's a zoo, and never during work hours if it's like, food is going to be my personal thing, so that's after work or maybe lunchtime. If I think of what you just described there, Cameron, I'm picturing other retailers or anyone in a B2C environment. And first-party data can be hard to get to unless you have a loyalty card. What are some of the tactics you would advise other retailers or B2C organizations to do to improve that access to first-party data?
Yeah, another great question. And it's hard because it's sort of like you need to reach the dish on the top shelf. If you're my wife and you're a whole like 5'1", she claims to be 5'2", she's not. And she asked me to go do it, who's 6'2", be like, well, honey, just get taller, right? That's not gonna be good advice for them, right? And so some of our first party data set, we're really blessed because it turns out if you want your pizza delivered hot and fresh into your house, you're willing to give us a lot of really good information about yourself, right? To make sure that happens. And when you've owned one of the most iconic pizza brands in the US or in some around the world for that matter, you get the opportunity over the years to collect a lot of that information that's useful. So that's like, so we started from a tall place sitting on the shoulders of a really great business. But that said, I think Taco Bell, I'm not sure like how exactly we quote these numbers, but I'll do the way we've in releases. Taco Bell, their first party data set, we've almost tripled over the last 3 years. And that has been through, number one, a lot of great work from Taylor Montgomery, who's the CMO of Taco Bell, and Dane Matthews, who's the chief digital officer at Taco Bell, coming together and saying, how do you mix a really great iconic brand that has its finger on kind of the cultural zeitgeist and then mix it with really good, strong digital strategies, not just around loyalty, not in a churn and burn world, like buy two tacos, get your third one for a star, but creating unique access. Well, how do you get into Taco Tuesday? How do you get invited to this New York event where you get previews of what's happening at Taco Bell and you get a taste of the most unique menu items? How do you do digital check-in so we can actually seamlessly recognize you and reward you as you show up in the drive-thru, which has not been typically seen as a digital channel? Those kind of really great strategies that go beyond churn and burn, like earn something, burn it, but actually create unique differences in the experiences and the value equation you offer back to your customers.
Yeah, and I can picture that experience, and I think everyone's mouths are watering now. We want to go. So listen to the podcast and go through the drive-thru now or order the pizza. It's great. As you think about, Cameron, you've touched on the business value. You've touched on change management, first-party data. Sometimes it's also your technology partnerships. And Yum! Brands just signed an agreement with NVIDIA. Tell us why you're excited about this.
Oh, man, I am so excited about this. It's so cool. Again, there's this vision. And the way I hear the story, I think I can share it. I don't think anybody at NVIDIA would be upset with this. NVIDIA has a limited set of partnerships they do. And they only pick one lighthouse partner within an industry. And so it turns out a year or so ago, they didn't have anything in the restaurant or the QSR industry. And they were trying to decide what to go get. And Jensen told his team, go get me one. And so they went out and they reached out to one of our partners. And they came back to Jensen and said, hey, look, we got these folks. And Jensen's like, no, not big enough, not big enough. Go get me KFC. And so, and Jensen, like, who travels internationally, understood the scope of what KFC is around the globe and how huge it is. And so they sort of reached out to us and said, would you be interested? And that started a set of conversations that had evolved to where it is today. I'm excited because, number one, they're one of the world's richest and most prolific companies. What people don't realize is how they really use software as a razor blades model to the chips and the hardware. So people think of them as a hardware company, but they're actually one of the world's largest software companies too. And they use that to go build that other scale. And so this partnership does a couple of things for us. It puts us on the map with them because they will only do these partnerships with people they feel have the credibility to work with them. So they vetted our teams. They vetted my AI team. They vetted our software teams. Like, yep, it's real, it's strong. So they sort of validated the strength of our technology strategy and our talent. The second thing that it did is on all this software, whenever you sign a software contract, as you well know, you've been in this space, there's a reason why you take like those seats on the cab, right? Like I got to invest time, but I want to have influence on your strategy, your product strategy, your feature strategy. What this partnership does is it basically gives us frontline access to how we manage that strategy and say, hey, these are the things we would like your ASR to do better. Okay, got it. And we get a frontline access to that. And then thirdly, it gives us access to their like rock star engineering team, best in class engineering team. So we're partnering right now with things that we say, hey, we think we can do this. It's sort of innovative. It's a little bit of a moonshot. They're like, we can do that. We can develop it. And then there you go. And so you do it in a way that's clean on the IP, but it basically extends my team with some of the most talented engineers, data scientists, and machine learning engineers on the planet. So I love this. I love working with them. They're such a great set of folks, so smart.
Yeah. And it sounds like then in this time of rapid innovation where, you know, the reality is NVIDIA is building and learning as well. So it's prioritizing being maybe part of some of these customer advisory boards so that your engineering teams, your AI teams are learning as well and having a voice in how you design it. So there's a lot to be excited about, Cameron. What are you nervous about, or where would you advise leaders to be more cautious as they embrace Gen AI?
Yeah, I think we're all seeing the research coming out now. Are we moving into that like slough of despair, right? Which we've all seen in the typical world? Can it do what it needs to do? It's also really easy as you start moving into these reasoning engines, when you start seeing the token burns.
So the cost.
The cost gets really expensive. The environmental impact, like one, creating one AI image is the equivalent of charging your cell phone one time. That's the general rule of thumb here. And so I think we're all sitting back and saying, okay, wait, this is exciting. You could do some really cool stuff with it. But, you know, how do you not get stuck in Jevons paradox of this idea of like, well, the thing becomes cheaper, but you use a lot more of it. And so your total costs just keep going up. And so, like, we know that tokens will get less expensive, but reasoning engines will get more complex. The questions we ask them will get more complex. How do we balance that out? How do we not just help people say, this isn't just a blank check, right? Don't just play with it and waste it. Use it effectively because there really is a cost to it.
Yeah, and that cost can be both a financial cost, but as we build the infrastructure to handle these workloads, should data and AI and business leaders actually be looking at the climate costs? Or is that, nope, that's NVIDIA or OpenAI or Google's problem?
Look, we all live in the planet. So I'd say, like, we all want to drink clean water and breathe fresh air. So I think we all should care about it. And as those of us that are driving the demand, like, we should care about it too. And how do we continue to evolve on that?
Yeah. And you've mentioned already how you are honing the skills of the employees at Yum Brands, but you also mentioned your grandchildren, your children. So as you think about the workforce being impacted by AI now, what are your recommendations both for people just entering the workforce, but also how companies should focus on this ongoing reskilling?
Yeah, I get a lot of this from college students coming out and mentoring. And I think, luckily, my kids are sort of beyond that in their careers. But I think learning the skills are key. The way we're teaching people, GPT is just our corporate license. What we use are many other tools, learning how to use the tools. But I'm watching my daughter, who's a registered nurse, how she's starting to use it in her role. It's like, hey, this is actually really helpful, both from a personal perspective. Like, I'm using it to plan menus because I'm really busy. And how do I, like, feed four kids and deal with that and be at work? Like, how do I do that? All the way to the way it's starting to come up in the medical space. And so learning the tools is like anything else. When I entered my first jobs coming out of academia into finance, I knew how to use Lotus 1-2-3 and I'd played with Excel. Right. But at some point, my speed on a keyboard with Lotus 1-2-3 was not going to serve me going into a finance career at Disney in the early 90s. I had to learn how to use those tools. Right. And I think Gen AI is going to be the same way. And then how do we continue to invest? And this is what we're doing at Yum. We've got a set of investments. How do we upskill and not just our above restaurant leaders, but this is part of our AI and our BITE strategy. How do we put these tools? We have a restaurant coach app that we put in our restaurant general manager's hands that not just helps them with routines, but will now start to recommend what's the next action for you. Like, what should you do? This is happening at your restaurant now. Do this, right? The same way my car, like, will rumble at me if I get too close to the center line. Right? I still have to drive the car, right there, but like, this is like, how do I rumble the guardrails to make decision support faster and easier for you? And getting used to using those tools of the change management and trusting them will be part of how we evolve.
Yeah, you made me smile there, Cameron. Lotus 1-2-3. Out of college, I was the one Lotus 1-2-3 macro queen, but I never got quite as good at Excel macros and definitely not Google Sheets. But there you have it.
There you have it, right? It will just continue to evolve.
Yeah. Cameron, it's a delight talking about the strategies at Yum, food, data, and AI. We're going to shift to a lighthearted lightning round What do you enjoy doing outside of work when you're not immersed in the world of data and AI?
Wow. It's two things. One, I'm a degenerate golfer. And so I play a lot of golf. And half of those rounds are just by myself walking a course because I love just the thinking time of it. Doing nothing but that and focus. And then, as I mentioned, I've got seven grandchildren. Four of them live literally 100 yards away. And so I spend a lot of time with grandkids and I love it. It's, if I'd known it was going to be this much fun, I would have just started here. So they take up a lot of my
lucky
space
you.
And time.
Well, a golfer recently told me I'm never allowed to ask somebody what is their handicap. So I'm going to ask you, what's your favorite golf course that you wish you could play on or that you'd go back to playing on?
There's two. Anybody who's played Pebble loves Pebble. It's just so iconic. You can't not play there. Actually, my favorite course to play that's less iconic is Isle of Wight down in Orlando, which is a great, it's Tiger's old course. And it's a wonderful private course. Amazing layout and green complexes, always in beautiful shade.
Yeah, well, I love the view from Pebble Beach in Monterey, California, or Carmel, really. But how about someone, famous or not, that really inspires you?
Yeah, we're doing some work tomorrow with The Economist, and so this has been top of mind. My favorite, I think my hero is Thomas Sowell. And I just love his story. Like here's a man of color born in the 1930s in North Carolina, Gastonia, North Carolina, ends up as an orphan, raised in Harlem, drops out of high school early, ends up in the Marines, survives the Korean War, comes back on the GI Bill, goes to Harvard and graduates with honors from Harvard with an economics degree. Ends up at Columbia, University of Chicago for his PhD, all in the 30s, 40s, 50s, if you think about it, 60s, has now written over 30 books, is known as one of the most sort of data-driven economists when it comes to social theory, economic theory. And he has a quote, it's one of my favorite quotes, which is, there's no such thing as solutions, only trade-offs.
Good. And we'll be sure to link to his work in the show notes. And then you can choose the last one, depending on your mood at the moment, either a recent moment that has totally made you laugh out loud, or what are you most grateful for, maybe beyond the obvious of health and family and those wonderful grandchildren?
Laugh out loud. This probably won't translate, but I'm going to go with it anyway, which is of my seven, there are a set of two-year-old twins that live next door, and they're boys, and it is a constant source of amusement and pleasure to watch those two torture their mother. And we were recently at a pumpkin patch, and the larger of the two was like grabbing on his mother for whatever reason, because like two-year-olds do this stuff. And she had a backpack behind her, and he somehow managed to get, I don't even know how he managed to do this. He managed to get his head up in the strap of the backpack trying to get something. And then he couldn't get out, and his toes were there. And you're sort of watching this from the back. And so his mother hears him fussing and so tries to turn to get him. But like now he's off the ground. So he swings this way. She can't see him, and he's still fussing.
Gosh.
So she's trying to, and you just got to imagine watching all this from about 50 feet away. And she then turns the other way to try to get him, and his little bobblehead just swinging on the back of his backpack as he's fussing, and she can't get him, and he doesn't know what's going on, and everybody trying to run to help the little guy until they finally get him down, and he's like, cookie, all he cared about. And his mother, who's just like devastated, everything. So I was choking my child. So again, the story doesn't translate, but you just have to watch it. And I just, as imagine, as a grandfather, the grandmother was there dealing with it, so I just sat back and laughed my head off. It was hilarious to watch.
It translates beautifully. I can picture that. So thank you for sharing that memory with us. And thank you so much for being on the Data Chief podcast, Cameron.
Thank you for having me, Cindy. My pleasure.
Thank you for joining the Data Chief as we explore data and AI leadership. To continue your journey, subscribe to our podcast on your preferred listening platform and connect with me on LinkedIn or X at BI Scorecard. If you are loving this podcast,
please rate or review it so others can also discover the podcast.
The Data Chief is brought to you by ThoughtSpot, the agentic analytics platform company built for everyone to create personalized insights, drive decisions, and take action. Learn how companies like Lyft, Brambles, and Navan are leading the way at ThoughtSpot.com.